Bruce Williams may not be a household name in your house, but he is the most popular talk show host in the nation. He's never had a guest on his show, and he plays solitaire and deals himself poker hands while he talks to over 3 million listeners every working day. What does he talk about? Money, mostly, and everything that's related to it. He's called the High Priest of Financial Advice, the Yogi of the Airwaves. Williams says...
Where'd you get all this material?
Williams says
me.
He talks about life. This is Bruce Williams you're listening to, folks.
Oh, my goodness gracious. I mean, this sounds like something from Grimm's Fairy Tales.
Hold the phone.
Yes, ma'am.
Whatever the subject, one thing is sure. The nation listens to Bruce Williams. This is Conversations for KUAC FM in Fairbanks. I'm your host, Susan McGinnis, and the voice you just heard is that of Bruce Williams.
Susan.
For the next hour, we'll be talking to the King of Talk. There's no number to call, so sit back. We'll spend an hour with Bruce Williams.
This is embarrassing.
Look, why?
My goodness, crap. First of all, it's $10 million, not $3 million. Let's get to that.
Well, now, you know, that's a question. I read somewhere that you had 10 million listeners, and then I read elsewhere that you had 3, and when I called TalkNet, they said I'd have to ask the man. They can't tell me.
Well, I don't know either.
Is it 10?
The problem with these numbers is, you see, you got to talk about rating services which you may or may not belong to.
Right.
And if you don't belong to them and you quote their numbers... then you got a serious problem. I'm sure you're aware of the mechanics of that.
You bet.
Like, it's like playing a song. You don't pay BMI a royalty on the thing. I don't know. There's at least a half a dozen people out there. Let's leave it at that. We did this postcard thing. You're aware of that. My nobody thing.
I'm a nobody.
You're a nobody. Did you send me a card?
I did not, no.
Well, then you're not a nobody.
I didn't
have
15
nobody.
Cents.
Well, I'd have loaned you the money at a reasonable interest rate. But what I got really aggravated, you see. I'm talking to one of these teeny bopper agency people. You know, they're about 23. They're just barely out of the clear assault set. And she starts up with and I really don't have any interest in sales. I have interest, but it's not my job. And she said, nobody listens to talk radio and nobody listens to AM radio. Now, I happen to know that at least 4 or 5 people listen. I know that for a fact, right?
Yeah.
So I got a little annoyed with this whole thing. And I went on the air and I said, you folks are all nobodies. Because after all,
nobody listens.
You're a nobody. Nobody listens to AM, and nobody listens to talk. Everybody listens to country and listens to rock and roll, you see. Now, I tried to make it as easy as I could, because let's face it, listeners are hurtling down the highway at 65 miles an hour, watching the Fuzzbuster and whatever. They can't write down addresses. So I picked an address which I figured even the least able among them could remember, and I searched the Atlas, and I found a community called Bruce. It happened to be in South Dakota, population 200. And I had a long, serious chat with a postmistress, and then with her bosses in Sioux City or Sioux Falls or some unlikely spot. And we commandeered the post office at Bruce, South Dakota, and they said, just send me a postcard.
That.
And over 100,000 people did. So I got a feeling that a great agency, I don't know how to compensate them for it, said you shouldn't call them nobodies, N-O, call them nobodies, K-N-O-W. Which I thought was a pretty good idea.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, I don't know how many listeners, at least a half a dozen, and if we get lucky, we'll pick up another half a dozen along the way. What difference does it make, really?
Well, let's look at these half a dozen people. Why do you think... Now, this is essentially a money show.
No, it's not.
All right.
Stop right there.
Then you tell me what this show's
about. I do a
show
about life. Now, if money is part of our lives, then I do a show about life. Let's talk... You and I drove over here from wherever it is I've been. We had a number of conversations, some of which we can talk about and some we can't, right? Sure. I said I'd never tell. But think about some of those conversations. We talked about a time when you were in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And what did we talk about? What did you do while you were in New York? Well, we talked about you. Where did you go to school? What did you study in school? And so on and so forth. Every one of those conversations has money as a necessary ingredient. It is the Portland cement that held the conversation together. Yet, it would be a pretty empty meal if that's all you talked about was the money. But let's face it, why? You're at a university setting here. Now, I don't want to bust a balloon, but the majority of young people that are coursing through these halls on a business day are here because they're trying to put beans and rice on a table. Someday, they want to know about Kant and a little bit about the arts, but basically they're here to learn how to make a living. That's unless they're born with a silver spoon in their mouth, that's essential.
Mm-hmm.
So we spend a great deal of our time pursuing money. If we talked about children, well, first thing you say is, boy, it costs a ton to support them, to feed them, to clothe them, to educate them, and so on and so forth. So to that extent, I do a money show, but only to that extent. I don't. You see, when you conjure up a financial show in your mind, if you're doing this mental sketch. What do you get? Well, you get some stocks and bonds and arbitrage. And if that isn't soporific, I've never found anything it would be. I mean, about 30 seconds of that, and I would be deep in the heart of Morpheus. I'm gone. I'd sleep.
Yeah.
And I think the audience would as well. However successful they are, they don't get big audiences, those shows. They get big advertising dollars, not big audiences. Mm-hmm. Now, what you started to ask was, why do people listen? And I think there are a lot of reasons for that. I'd like to think there's a little bit of entertainment involved. But unlike you said in your opening monologue, which I rudely interrupted, but then I'm like that. I don't take this as seriously as most people do. This is, as I mentioned, we came in, not brain surgery. If we screw up, all right, you look a little foolish.
We live.
But that's not the end of the world. Yeah. Nobody's going to be injured by that. There are things that we could say that could injure people. But the point I was trying to make was that we talk about life as life is. If you do an interview program, let's take Larry King, who I listen to, and we work for the same company, and I know the guy pretty well. If Larry King has Tommy Lasorda on his show, I'm gone. I'm history. I don't dislike Mr. Lasorda, but I don't care for baseball especially. There's nothing he's going to say has any interest to me. Maybe he lost a little weight. I'm always interested in that. But that aside, he has nothing for me. So I'm gone. On the other hand, if he's going to have H.R. Haldeman on, he may capture me for the whole evening. I may go home and flip the radio on. But the problem with that scenario is, suppose he has someone who I'm interested in. Oftentimes, it's, again, to use the university analogy, there are requisites and prerequisites. If you miss the first 15 minutes, you may be dead in the water because they've set the scene. If you miss that, or conversely, if you want to leave after the first act, you've left with very little. Now, we do something a little different, don't we? I would consider that a banquet, a heavy meal. I have an hors d'oeuvre tray, lots of hors d'oeuvres on it. Mm-hmm. So you're riding along in your car and your truck and whatever, and you're at the end, you flip on for whatever reason, and I'm talking about something that you think is inane, stupid, but you may hang out because you know 5 minutes later that is history, and I may get involved in something that you might find entertaining, interesting, or whatever. So there's a constant change of venue, which I think works. Furthermore, do you recall CBS Mystery Theater series?
Yes.
High Brown stuff? Very good stuff.
Good stuff.
Absolutely. But there was a problem with that. Problem was, on the radio, a significant portion of the people who listen are in automobiles, and they are not in for 50 minutes. So I oftentimes, and I like that stuff, but I'd be in my car, deliberately turn it off. Why? Because I know I'm going to be in the car for 20 minutes. Now they got me hooked. I'll never find out who killed, was it the butler or not? So I'd turn it off completely. Now, if I were on the road and I'm going somewhere, man, I think that was money from home if I happened to find one. If you were to look in the trunk of my automobile today, you're going to find at least 50 tapes of old radio programs, right back to Will Rogers, who wasn't very funny, by the way. That would have disappointed me. I have 6 hours of original Will Rogers stuff. And the people in the audience weren't laughing. I mean, clearly there's a lot of topical stuff. And these were done in the late 20s and early 30s. Wasn't funny then, which is very disappointing. I would figure maybe I could lift a line or two. You always steal from Heavier Howie. He ain't going to complain. He's out of business now for the last 50 years. Wasn't he going to steal? He was not very funny. I have Jack Benny, Gracie Allen, and George Burns. I Love a Mystery, The Green Hornet. It goes on and on. I have a ton of that stuff, and I enjoy listening to that. Because I've been a radiophile and continue to be all my life.
I was going to ask you that. Do you listen to radio when you're not on
sure.
radio?
Sure.
Yeah.
I listen to these guys. I never listen to talk radio. These are talk show hosts. Mm-hmm. Well, it shows. They don't listen. It shows. They don't know anything about what's going on around them. I listen. I can tell you, if I were interviewing you for a job, as I do periodically on my show, what do you suppose my first question is? And if you can't answer that, Sue, you're out of business. Don't try to impress me how good you are.
What do you know about the business you're interested in?
No, that's not what I ask you. I ask you something more pointed.
What?
Tell me, name top 10 top talk show hosts and what they do. Mm-hmm. If you can't answer that, you're out. Because I want somebody, not just wants a job, I want somebody who wants a job in radio. And I want a job, if somebody wants a job in my kind of radio. I want them to be as much of a radio freak as I am. When I was first out of the service a million years ago, when you were single, you didn't think about getting your own place. It just wasn't done. You lived at home until you got married, male or female. That doesn't mean you couldn't go out and play around, do whatever you wanted to do, not come home at night, but you still lived at home. Now, that's your generation was different, but that was mine, okay? But if you walked into my old man's house and flipped the radio on at 3 o'clock in the morning, I mean, you were flirting with death. I mean, he wouldn't tolerate that kind of stuff. The fact that I was back from a war, I'm supporting my day, it didn't matter. I used to sit in the garage 3 o'clock in the morning after I come in from a date and listen to Long John Nebel, Biggie Wilson, and I listened to these guys because I really enjoyed that stuff, you see. So I was a listener way before I was whatever I am. And I suspect I will be a listener well beyond any time I'm participating. Because I think it's a very special medium. Mm-hmm.
They said it was going to be buried in the 50s. Radio was out.
Wasn't it Mark Twain who had something to say about the reports of his death were exaggerated?
Mm-hmm. I think it is the intimacy. And I also think it's the no glitz.
Well,
about radio that is attractive. What do you think?
Well, people, I mean, I don't know you. You are clearly, you have good radio style. I screwed up your monologue and I apologize, but
it's
you can do it over again and edit me out and you probably will. It's all right. But
it is what is.
Okay. I used to have a gal I worked with who you would probably know. She's done a lot of radio, but she made her name in television. Her name is Sally Jesse Raphael. Mm-hmm. You know Sally. I've known Sally for a long time. She is like a lot of us. You put a microphone in her face, and she'll tell you anything. When I say anything, she used to do a 10 to noon show in New York, and I did the 2 to 4 show on the same radio station. So I was commuting when she was doing her thing. And I was driving at the railroad station. I had to stay in the car. I want to hear the end of this. She is doing a monologue on an affair that she had. And when I tell you, we are getting very, very graphic. And I'm not going to get that graphic here. I'm talking about industrial strength, X-rated graphic. And she's just telling the story. Now, I go in the office. I mean, I had to hear the end of this on here. Hey, Sally. Oh, you think she could repeat that to me? She's all embarrassed. She's getting red-faced or whatever. But you see, with a microphone there, like the confessor, like her priest, she could just go on and on with the details. I have people come to me regularly and say, how was Matt's hand? How under the sun did you know about that? Well, you talked about it on your... Because I talk about
your son.
My life on the air. That's right. Exactly so. And I think you have to be able... Well, that's poorly put. You don't have to. There are people who are very successful that don't. But the most successful, for the most part, are able to talk. We are talking now to, I don't know how many people. I don't want to know. It doesn't matter. Whether it's 5 people, 500, 5,000, or 5 million, the microphone looks exactly the same. You look through the glass, there's an engineer. Exactly the same. The studios look the same. Whether it's 2,500 nighttime watts, and that's where I began in New Jersey, or over 300 and some odd stations. Not only now, it's not only North America, but AFRS picks us up all over the world.
Really?
So, but the microphone looks the same.
Yeah.
And a clock on a wall, which ticks me down and counts me off, looks the same. So what's different? It's rather like money, just adding zeros. And after a while, it doesn't matter.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Conversations on Public Radio, KUAC-FM in Fairbanks. We're talking to a man who is very much of public radio, but his medium is AM.
Well, we're on FM. I'm on about 50 FM stations.
Well, you're on 50 FM.
About, I don't know, somewhere. I don't even know how many stations I'm on, 240 something, or 340, something like that. Doesn't matter. They come, they go. But talk and conversation and news is largely an AM phenomenon and will remain so, I think.
His name is Bruce Williams. He's been in radio since 1975. They say since he decided to buy a radio station and realized he didn't know enough about the business to get into it.
Boy, is that not the truth.
And so he went in through the front door and got a job.
And then went full circle, bought a couple radio stations.
Sally Jesse Raphael says radio is family. Do you see your listeners?
People are so gracious, it's distressing. I mean, people will come up and they'll say, I feel I've known you for how many years and so on and so forth. And it is almost embarrassing, but it's certainly very rewarding that they'll do that kind of stuff, you know, that they will treat you that way, and I'm kind of happy that they do. But well, it's just what it's all about, in my opinion.
This is not to embarrass you, but it feels to me, in listening to you daily, that you care, and so your listeners,
well,
your family,
well,
only returns
that's true,
that to
sure,
you.
Sure, because these are my customers. I used to, every once in a while, you'd be in that great leveler of all men. That's the men's room at the urinal, right? Because everybody's the same, right? And some engineer would come in and say, boy, who is that blank blank that you just had on? What a... I said, wait a minute, hold the phone. Those are my customers. Now, admittedly, I get short with some of them, and I'm thinking, how can they pop? But nonetheless, they are my customers. And they're the people that pay your bills, so don't tell them either they're blah, blah, blah. Because, I've never met anybody I couldn't learn something from. Will Rogers never met anybody he didn't like. Well, I could introduce him to a few guys that would straighten that thing out in a hurry. But I have never met anybody I couldn't learn something from. Now, you say this guy's a real jerk, but boy, can he lay bricks. I mean, right in a row can he lay bricks. Or he can drive a truck and back a trailer into a slot with an inch on either side. Give that a try someday. I have never met anybody. The garbage guy, yeah, he can pick up a 200-pound can. You get a hernia.
Mm-hmm. And he can do it all day long.
Exactly,
and you can't do
so. So the point is that everybody does something better than you. Mm-hmm. I think I've learned to learn from people. I mean, I learned something from a stewardess on a plane yesterday. We got talking about some of the things. Do you know why a stewardess, why a stewardess crosses her legs? Because if there's a crash, her legs are held in toward her body, and she has a better chance of being able to walk and help the passengers. And she's supposed to cross her arms during takeoff and landing.
Same reason?
For the same reason. They don't get flailed around and get broken, because then she wouldn't be as useful. Now, I never knew that before, but I'll know it 30 years from now if I'm still alive.
Yeah. You're real honest with people on the air. I mean, well, I know you'll say, of course.
Well, sure. Yeah. First of all, I say I don't know. Now, that sets me a little bit aside, because we have people in our business that would rather walk through hot coals and clean septic tanks with drinking straws than to admit there was something they didn't know. I don't have a problem with that. I don't know. It comes right off the tip of my tongue. I don't know. And after four or five times, it was easy. I think that is a little bit different, you know? I say, I don't know. What's the big deal? Aside from that, I mean... I keep saying this is not brain surgery. Yeah. Isn't that tough?
Yeah.
Fortunately, if it was tough, I might have a problem.
This is a question about the people who call you and the nation in which we live. Do you think this nation is practical, sensible, thoughtful in the way it deals with its financial affairs, the affairs of its life?
Well, I think we ignore so many things that we should not ignore, if you want to ask it that way.
Like?
Well, you're sitting here, you got a bunch of kids going through the school, and you're going to teach them about the Emperor Constantine, the Byzantine Empire, but you don't teach them how to balance a checkbook. That's stupid. That's just dumb. No other way to describe it. We expect that people are going to learn these things through osmosis, how to budget. Mm-hmm. Well, you don't. You got to go out and get burned. There are two kinds of people, my son keeps telling me. One passes by a stove, and you say, that's a hot stove. You say, thank you very much. The other guy's got to smell burning flesh. Well, unfortunately, we seem to be tuned into the burning flesh mode when it comes to a lot of things that have to do with our financial lives. I don't want to beat that to death. But just the elementary stuff. We don't talk to, you know, we don't tell people why it's not cool to go out and run up big credit card bills. And how you control that and so on and so forth. And that's unfortunate.
And is it ignorance more than greed? I mean, I'm thinking about, this is taking it to the grand scale now, but mm-hmm. We've got a major SNL bailout going on here. We've got a national debt.
Yes,
we've got
true.
People mortgaged to the hilt, whether they're small guys or big guys.
All right.
Is it foolishness, ignorance, or greed?
Well, I think greed is probably the thing that's the engine that makes this all work, isn't it? Are you not greedy? Man, I am. I'm very greedy. Nothing wrong with greed. Now, you talk about the SNL thing. This can come as a great shock to most people. 95% of the SNL guys were honest. 95%. Only 5% was a matter of fraud.
And they took the house down.
Well, that's the way life is, Charlie. I invested in a bunch of real estate, and I'm taking it right up the nose right now. But I took a shot. didn't work out too well. Well, the jury's still out. And I think that's part of this SNL problem. They won't let the jury stay out long enough.
That's translate that. What do you mean?
Well, we got the Resolution Trust Company scurrying around to unload these properties. What the hell is a hurry? Why take the hit? For example, I was talking to the chairman of a board of a bank that I have a position in. Let it go at that, all right? I was in his office, I guess, Thursday. And he said, you know, so-and-so came in, and he's got a $300,000 loan with us. And he said, I can't make it. I gotta go into a voluntary foreclosure. And he said, wait a minute. It's a three-family building. How much does it generate in rent? Okay. How about we do this? We'll take that as payments every month. Instead of writing the loan off, that will keep the, forget about, we'll never see principal in the foreseeable future. But we'll still get our interest, so it's a current loan. Instead, if we repossess, if we're lucky, we come out with $200,000, we take a $100,000 hit. Mm-hmm. If we let the guy, we restructure the payments so the guy can make lighter interest payments, we have a current loan, and when the market comes back, as it must, 2, 3, 5 years, we get our $100,000. We don't take the hit. But no, we're gonna say a corporation that I own owns. Mm. Fair enough. A condominium which I think we paid $133,000 for, round numbers, maybe $135,000, doesn't really matter. And I think we borrowed about $100,000. That wouldn't bring $95,000 today. Technically, that's a bad loan. Technically. But as long as I make the payments, it's a good loan. Now, if I walk in and say I got a problem, what's better for the bank to say, let's kind of work this over and lower the interest and just pay interest only and sweat it out for 5 years together? Or, hey, either you make it or we're going to repossess. The time they get done selling it, if they sold it for $95,000, they're only going to realize $90,000. Now they're $10,000 down. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what's happening. You see, a lot of these guys loaned money on real estate values that were. When they're off 25 or 30% and people are taking a hike.
Yeah.
You got to make it attractive for them not to take a hike. We're not doing that. And then you want to compound it. You want to blame the savings and loan guys, huh? Let's talk about blaming somebody else called the members of Congress.
Who?
Who precipitated the real estate crash. How? 1986 tax reform took all of the incentive to invest in real estate out. And the smart guys immediately bailed out and left a lot of people, including me, because I wasn't smart, although I said what I'm saying to you on the Today Show in 1986. Before they voted for it, you guys are going to cripple the real estate industry because there's no tax incentive. Without tax incentive, why should I take the gamble? That's part of the problem, you see. It's not anywhere near as simplistic as some of these rascals would like you to believe. Yeah, we go after Neil Bush. He's got visibility. What does that amount to? Nothing.
So stick with nothing. What's real and be patient because things will come around full
cycle.
Well,
I think that to go out and act precipitously without thinking these things out. Real estate is clearly cyclical. I mean, history proves that.
Well, look at San Francisco. I mean, San Francisco, the Marin County area, has gone as high as it can go, and now it's going gently down.
And let's take a look at, which is almost a sister city to Alaska, Seattle. Mm-hmm. Seattle was in the dumper in the 80s when the rest of the world was doing great.
Right.
Seattle is appreciating at 30% when the rest of the world's in the sewer. Cyclical, clearly. Nothing. And it will always be so. But we are in this panic mode. Let's close them down. Let's get rid of their assets at a loss and eat it. Well, that, in my opinion, is a major, major mistake. We're just dumping more real estate on the market, which will exacerbate the problem. Now, if you can explain to me how that's smart, I want to listen.
You're listening to Bruce Williams. He's an AM radio man and called the king of talk show hosts. This is Conversations on KUAC. It feels to me that one of the major things you do in your program is to examine people's thinking and ask them to think critically. Does that wash with you? Is that an accurate read?
I think I try to help people reach what I consider to be reasonable conclusions. It's called the Socratic method of questioning.
Mm-hmm. Have you thought about this? Have you done this?
Ask questions to elicit the responses you're looking for.
Right.
I have no problem with that.
Yeah.
That seems to work.
Do you think most of us think critically?
Oh, I don't know about most. You see, you're looking for generalizations. I can't. Because you have to, I think
I'm looking for a read on your audience.
You'd have to, well, you'd have to amend that critically in what areas? We're back to the expertise again. Mm-hmm. The physician that calls about his septic tank is not stupid, but I don't think in medical school, too, they ever talked about septic tanks.
Right.
Son of a gun, I don't understand that, because I think you have more trouble with septic tanks than you do with, but that's another matter, right? Those are the things I think you have to address, and we're not addressing.
And this is one of the major reasons you suggest counsel people to hire an expert when
Know. Yes, let's say expert, because I'm not necessarily a lawyer, but lawyers are, in our litigious society, lawyers are an absolute requisite. You can't get away from them. What do you like it or what do you know? So you may as well accept the fact and work with them. Furthermore, it just seems to me, whether it's a lawyer or a gardener, if you really value your time, you don't cut your grass, you don't practice law. Unless you enjoy getting kidney disease, riding around in a lawnmower, you're wasting your time. You started working for $3 an hour, whatever you pay a kid to cut your grass. And as poorly paid as I could be, I still am worth more than $3 an hour. So I don't cut grass. I don't do those things. I walked into a friend's office, and this is some years ago. The guy is very successful. He owns more bulldozers than, you know, most people have socks. And I walk up there, because he and I used to play a lot of cards together. And he said, Albert, there's chaos outside. They're playing bumper tag with bulldozers. He's got his feet up in the air smoking a cigarette. I said, I know. I said, why the hell don't you do something about it? He said, no. He said, they have to walk downstairs and correct that. I just failed. I got guys down there. If they can't correct it, then I got to get rid of them. But if I got to go down there and straighten this mess out, and there's a mess down there, then I got to be thinking about 2 years from now, 3 years from now. Let's play some 21. We did. Learn something. But I've taught him a few lessons, too, about delegation of time. Albert would never take a vacation. He just came back from Europe for 3 weeks. And the place is still there.
Mm-hmm.
I try to explain to him that when you die, kid, it's still going to be there. And the company's big enough that it'll probably survive. So I vacation from time to time.
Stop.
Pardon?
You stop.
Yeah, I haven't called my answering service in a day and a half. Yeah, they'll make it work. I probably will call and get back to the hotel just to be sure it's not a crisis. But there's a real crisis, and they really needed me. They track me down. They'll figure out where I am. If it's just only a semi-crisis, don't you love it? I was in a bar. I spend a lot of time in bars, don't I? I was in a bar in Bermuda Friday afternoon, and I make the mistake of calling the office. And the gal starts out with, I don't know if I should tell you this or not and spoil your weekend. Now, what a great way to start a conversation. I'm now levitating over the bar. Spit it out! I really forget what the crisis was. But what a way to start a conversation. Better I didn't know. Because what was I going to do in Bermuda over the weekend to solve the problem? Don't tell me. Well, at least let me, you know, have the weekend. But you see, when you're the boss, sometimes you don't get that privilege. But that's part of being a boss, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not every once in a while you get a chance to wind down and you meet people and have a good time, and that's what makes it worthwhile.
I read somewhere that you were a boss early.
Said, oh, yes. It says one about 12, 13.
Yeah, one of the bios said that when you were 12, 13 years old, you had about 200 kids working for you.
Many more than that, yeah.
What was that about?
Well, and it's, you know, it really came full circle because I'm still buying from the same guy I bought from years ago. What we did was we used to buy, well, first of all, mistletoe, you know, the stuff you get neck under, right? You know, you buy it in little boxes and stuff. Mistletoe never came packaged that way. Mistletoe used to come in big boxes, and you broke off a branch. Well, we found, I don't know how we got involved with this, frankly, but we found out you could buy damaged mistletoe for next to nothing because the berries are all off in the bottom of the box, and nobody wanted to buy it. Well, at that time, again, plastic was not ubiquitous as it is today, but there were little plastic bags they used to put nuts in. The machines were called Double K Nuts, and they had the cashews went around in circles, and right? I went in and looted all the bags out of the nut machine, bought the mistletoe, put a handful of berries in the bottom of the bag, then shoved the branch in so you couldn't tell, taped it with red scotch tape, and now we bought the stuff for next to nothing. We also bought Christmas corsages, which were in vogue then, for 18 cents a copy. And we used to open up next to a school, elementary school. And the kids would come in. We didn't get their names. You're number 36. Give them 4 bags of mistletoe, 3 corsages. He made a nickel on mistletoe, a dime on a corsage. He had hundreds of kids wrapping on doors. People used to put the stuff on their door They buy one and pin it on the door to keep the other kids away. And two or three days by elementary school A, we moved to the next elementary school. And we, at 13 or 14, now we're talking when a grown man could make $100 a week, we were making $600 and $700 a week doing this.
What brought it to mind?
Who knows? I've been a hustler ever since I was. I was at the tag of World War II, there were no toys. Toys were impossible to get hold of. And realize I'm only 10 maybe at this point, 10 or 11. And it was a different era in many ways. When they gave a kid a chemistry set, he could blow up the store. And one of the things you could buy for any, and the kid, parents gave me, I can imagine a parent do this today, was a mold where you poured molten lead into the mold and out came a little toy soldier. You could get two out of one mold is what it worked.
At 10 years old, you were pouring molten lead in the basement?
I went across and I bought old lead, real legitimate lead pipe because they were pulling out of houses because it was causing some problems. You could get plenty of lead during World War II.
Health problems,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they were taking them out of these old tenements. Yeah. And I went to the plumber right across the street and I bought lead pipe and we had a coal furnace in the house, naturally. And I got a crucible someplace, God knows where. And I melted the pipe, all the debris would come to the surface, skim it off. Now I got a big crucible of lead. And I'd cast out 300-400 of these little soldiers. Then I'd clean up the castings, dip them all in olive drab paint, and I put features on them, had them hanging all over the place, and I put them on my bike, got to pedal them to stores. And they bought them. They were anything, any kind of a toy was, the stores were empty of toys at the tag end of the war in 44, early 45. And I used to go on my bike, pedaling my little butt all over town, pedaling these things.
More than pocket money.
Oh, yeah. I never was satisfied with pocket money. Even in high school, I always had money. I mean, more than most kids had. Because I worked 40, 50 hours a week when I was in high school and played sports and the rest of it.
Jobs or businesses of your own?
Both.
And did you start investing at that point? Or did you just have money?
I made some investments, some good and some not so swell.
Mm-hmm. But you
won started, a few, lost a few.
You started learning early, though. How to be
sure, but you could do those things then. Mm-hmm. See, we're this is something I'll probably talk about one day. We are a nation of hypocrites.
Translate, please.
Well, you don't have children. I elicited that from you earlier, but I'm sure you know people that do.
Just about everybody I know.
Well, most people anyway. Okay. Yeah. And there isn't a guy or gal in the world over 35 that hasn't said to their kid, when I went to school, I used to walk 25 miles a day. We only have one pair of shoes in the family.
Right.
My sister got the left shoe. I got the right shoe.
That's right.
And after I got home from this 50-mile joint at 30 below zero, I milked 40 cows, and I got straight A's and never gave my mother and father any trouble. Is that not true? You got that story from your parents, and I gave it to my kids the whole. Why? What was it, Bill Cosby? He said he used to go through 8 foot of snow, and he lived in Puerto Rico. I mean, really. Now, that's all very well. So we talk about the work ethic. And when I was a kid, you could get a job. Now, we have this chief hypocrite, Mrs. Dole, head of the Department of Labor, going on today's show. We are going to shut down these exploiters of children. Terrific. Now, we're not talking about the Shirtwaist Fire in 1906. Things have changed since then. We're not talking about migrant laborers, which is a whole different matter. I don't have any quarrel with shutting that faucet off. We're talking about ordinary kids like you got frequenting this place when they're 4 years younger. Think about the ironies here. When a kid is 16 years old, what's the driving age in Alaska? I don't know. 16?
Yeah.
All right. That kid is 16. He can hop himself in with a 450-horsepower car, go into the self-service gas station, fill it up with gas, check the oil, and then race down a highway and maybe kill himself. But he can't work in the full-serve aisle because it's a hazardous occupation. The kid can be a mall rat and hang out till 1 o'clock in the morning in a mall and raise all kinds of hell, but he can't work in a mall past 10 o'clock because he's under 18. Fair enough? The youngster of 15 or 16, a little girl, can go down and get an abortion on demand, but she can't work in a hospital and help with that abortion because, after all, we got to protect her from working, but the abortion itself is clearly in the public interest, all right? And the before we get to that, your kid, my kid, whatever, can drive these fast cars, but he can't cut the grass until he's 18 because that's a hazardous occupation. And the ultimate is, at 17 years old, he can go get killed in the Army because he can go with his parents' permission. But his parents cannot, and he can get married too, but his parents cannot give him permission to cut that grass.
So the next chapter of the book is, why is it any surprise that he can't balance a checkbook,
keep a job? No. It's even more profound than that. The fact is, I'd rather have the kid working in the mall than hanging around the mall. I'd rather have her help him with abortions than getting an abortion. I'd rather have him pumping gas than driving a fast car. But we have passed so many child labor laws. And here's Mrs. Dole, and they're going to shut down McDonald's and Burger King and the rest of them. Well, I would rather have the kid making French fries than hanging out in the parking lot dealing Coke. And those are your choices. But we're, and you know who, and you know the major hypocrite of all, the labor unions, because they don't want these kids competing with their members for jobs. Now, that's ridiculous. It's wrong. It's stupid. It's immoral. And any other term you want to apply. Because we keep telling our kids, you should work. And then we put every possible roadblock in their way and in the employer's way. Triple awards if they get hurt. Got to have, I don't know what Alaska calls for. Most states you have to have working papers and physicals and the rest of it. Why not at least give them the same consideration you give an immigrant? Give them a green card. One physical, and then they can go get a job by flashing the card. And you give that to them automatically in high school if they ask for it. Make a lot of sense, wouldn't it? But you see, sensible government is something that we have never managed to put together. Why is it going to be sensible now? And I'm speaking as a former elected official, you see. I fooled them twice. I mean, I got elected and reelected.
Mm-hmm. You served as deputy mayor.
Yeah, no big deal.
Yeah, in New Jersey.
But it's just another experience, that's all.
Well, I was going to ask you somewhere along the line if you thought there was too much government. It's not just too
absolutely.
Much, it's the wrong kind, right?
Both. Too much and wrong. One of the things that I pride myself with, I repealed more laws than I passed. We are so overregulated in this country. We're overzoned. Why can't they cut the budget? Why? Because you're top-heavy in bureaucrats. That's why. And every one of them has a sinecure. And every one of them is going to defend that sinecure. We don't need all that. We don't need the government. We need fire. We need police. We need a road gang. We need some people in education, nowhere near as many as we got. Mm-hmm. I had a woman, did she rip me? She ripped the new yes in me here in, where was it? Dallas or Fort Worth a week or so ago. And she said, you know, I like what you said about school nurses. I said, yeah, I'll say it again. One of the biggest pieces of patronage I ever had to dispense was school nurse positions. Let's face it, you're working 5 hours a day, you're making more money than the poor woman in the operating room. You don't have to work in the summertime. You don't have to work weekends. You get every holiday off. And you can't give a kid an aspirin. Now, let's compare that against the woman who works on a hospital floor, who works 8 hours. She's sticking needles in people, changing bedpans, making life and death decisions. Well, but after all, we should get paid the same as why? I said, school nursing is a joke. It's an absolute joke. Whether you need somebody there or not can be argued. But please don't tell me you're overworked as a school nurse when you're doing heights and weights. Because I remember getting my brains beat out. I helped your election make my wife a school nurse because of the hours and the rest of it that went with it. Mm-hmm. Now, it just seems to me, pay them less. And the gal that's working from midnight to 5 in the intensive care unit, pay her more. But we have this idea, well, a nurse is a nurse is a nurse. A doctor, you know, whoever. The real world shouldn't be like that. You don't say that the guy who's hitting 320 is going to get paid as this guy who's hitting 250, do you? No, you pay for performance. Right now, airplane pilots aren't paid all that much. But there's plenty of pilots around. If there are less pilots, they'll raise the rates. I have no quarrel with that. That's the law that people say you're overpaid. I don't disagree with that. I get paid a lot of money. Come and take my job. It's so easy. And I know somebody's going to do just that. God knows enough people after me, but that's as it should be. That's healthy. I figure as long as I hear footsteps there behind me, it's dust that concerns me. If I see dust, I got a real problem. As long as I hear footsteps, I know they're back there somewhere. I don't mind that. I'm not afraid of competition.
As a nation, afraid of competition?
Oh, we got a serious problem. This nation will be a third world nation if we don't straighten out in a hurry.
And straighten out means what?
It means start to work for a living again and start this, depending on that government that you just described. From a cradle-to-grave care. I mentioned
the Chinese
earlier to you,
call it the Iron Rice Bowl.
Pardon?
The Chinese call it the Iron Rice Bowl.
The Orientals are going to kill us, and with good reason. They're better right now. They produce. They work. The Koreans in New York have taken over what was an unprofitable enterprise, the greengrocer business, and made it into a very profitable venture. Why? They're open 24 hours. Everybody in the family works, and they get the job done. Can you hate them for that? The boat people 10 years ago came over, and their kids are graduating cum laude. Can you hate them for that? I can't. All you did was give them a shot.
What did we do? Did we get comfortable and
fall
asleep? Sure,
we got fat and comfortable. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, history just demonstrates this time and time again. We'll pick another ethnic group. It doesn't bother me anymore. Take the Jews. Jews that came to this country through Ellis Island at the turn of the century, left everything in the Soviet Union or Poland or Czechoslovakia, whatever, they came over with nothing but the clothes in their, a couple of bucks in their pocket, maybe. They settled the Lower East Side of New York, and they pushed push carts around and worked their tail off. They were wanted something better for their kids, and their kids got something better. They got an education, whatever, and they worked. But the next generation that they produced never knew what it was like to have a hungry day. And you had a lousy third generation. Not everybody, certainly. It's not meant to be an ethnic indictment, but I mean my Jewish friends are the ones that bring this out. That third generation had it too easy. And all of a sudden they want to work 35 hours. Now, I suppose there's nothing wrong with 35 hours. But I've never worked 35 hours. I've worked 80, 90. Nobody ever gave it to me. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't smart enough to maybe make it in 35 hours. Maybe that's the answer. I don't know.
Well, but you said in other interviews that everybody you know wants to be a millionaire, but
very few people want to put out the... That's right. Yeah. And there are those that do. That's right. Everybody wants to go to heaven. Nobody wants to die. And you got to die to get there. I mean, that's a requisite to get to heaven. You got to die.
Pay the price.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
But everybody wants to go to heaven. Nobody wants to die.
Here's a question about the state of the state, and I suppose that's what I want to ask
Your
you
state
about.
Or our state?
The economy. Look at money. We hear in the news that we're on the brink of recession.
But it depends on where you are. Some places are in a recession.
Huh. Major
Not
problems.
Seattle.
Trade deficit, budget deficit.
Yep.
Major bills due.
And I can hear Pericles sitting around talking to his friends. That younger generation.
Okay,
and what those guys are doing down in the state capital has got to stop. I mean, they're spending our money like it was trash, and the drachma isn't worth what it used to be worth.
That's right. It's no different than forever. I understand this. When you were young, and my parents were having
when
babies.
When I was young. Watch your mouth, girl. The interview is over. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
It's been awfully nice. We're having a short program today. Mm. The host has just insulted the guest.
Boy, I'll tell you, you zung it to me, but it's all right.
All right. So when you were growing up.
I like that. Now, you see, you're learning.
And my folks were having kids.
Yeah.
Your generation and their generation were convinced that the economy was good, the future of America was good.
I'm still convinced of all that.
If you worked hard, you'd do better than your folks. There's no doubt about it. They say about the next generation, your kids and my peers, that that's not going to be true for us because this country is in decline.
You got screwed by some of the things that happened, but that's life. Too bad for you.
Are we in decline? That's what I want to know from you. What do you think?
Are there things that that my kids couldn't do that I did, clearly? I bought my first house when I was a sophomore in college, and it wasn't all that big a deal, okay? For one of my kids to buy that same house, same sticks and mortar, he had to make over $50,000 a year as an undergraduate, which is obviously not reasonable. So I got a break in that point in time, okay? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when I was growing up, you couldn't walk the streets in the middle of summer because you had to worry about polio. They don't have that problem anymore. There's some quid pro quo. You give a little, you get a little. I have a theory about life that we are all... Do you own your own home?
Mm-hmm.
No, you don't.
Well, the bank and I share
it. No, if you owned it outright, you don't own it. You rent it.
From?
History.
You
only rent your little continuum here, you see. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I could have survived 1,000 years ago at the same little place in my real estate where I live, or indeed 200 years ago, or 500, or 10,000. And I have no way of knowing if I could survive 1,000 years hence. But I do know I don't have that choice to make. I am here in 1990. I ain't here in 1930, and I'm not here in 2020. And I have my little rental agreement that I can keep my spot on this world for a relatively short period of time, and I'm going to become history. So I'm renting my time, and I'm going to do the best I can in that time. Are we going to go through some perilous economic time? Sure. Could I go broke? Absolutely. I hope not. Have I made some bad investments? Oh, have I made some bad investments. But I've never met anybody who's done anything that hasn't made some bad ones. Can I bounce back? The jury is very much out, isn't it? If I went broke today, I think I have enough ability to do it again. But I may be wrong. I don't ever want to have to put it to the test. But if I do, I must. I can't go into some kind of a vacuum until, quote, better times come along. Sure, housing is proportionally more difficult to acquire by this generation than the last. But then it was a hell of a lot easier for mine than the generation that preceded me. Because it was the conventional wisdom put 50% down and paid off in 5 years, so a lot of people couldn't own homes. Renting was a much more common thing in the 20s than it was after the 40s when we had the Levitts of the world and the GI Bill and all the things that made home ownership ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. So you got to take it as it slides. I don't want to hear this stuff, this garbage of, well, you had it easy, but you can't do it today, because it is purely garbage. I've got a standing wager that I could go to any community in the country of any substance with an old truck, a driver's license, and $1,000, and earn $40,000 over and above my living the first year, with no academic credentials, nothing, no credit, nada. Grand, old truck, driver's license, and me. And I'm willing to bet $100,000 I can do it. I'll bet $200,000 I can do it.
And you'd rely on hard work and your imagination.
I relied on me.
Yeah.
In a strange environment. And I know I could do it in 2 months, you see. But I give myself a year because I always take an edge. But I could do it in 2 months, 3 months outside. Now, if a dummy like me could do it, tell me why anybody else can't do it. The answer is you can. Opportunity is everywhere. Everywhere. I mean, people are just, oh, it just, it, it, you had a kid here a few years ago, started a little business in his garage with a buddy, and finally it got away from him, and he had to hire some outside people. And this was very, very quick. What do you know what I'm talking about? And they kicked him out of his own business. Yeah, they took it away from him. Well, of course, they gave Stephen Jobs $400 million on his way out of Apple Computer before he reached 30. He was not 30 years old. $400 million. Let that roll off your tongue. Tell me how. Another kid started a business in Omaha, Nebraska, selling pizza. 8 years later, he sold it for $240 million, Godfather Pizza. And you had another guy who was on the other side of the age thing. He wasn't real big with bedtime for Bonzo, but he got the top job in the country for 8 years, Mr. Reagan. Mm-hmm. Where else can these things happen? Nowhere.
I heard when you started in radio, I've heard two stories.
Well, there's a lot of stories.
One or two of them is true, maybe both.
Nah, probably none of them, but that's all right.
One was, we started this in 1975, you were going to buy a radio station.
May 14th, 1975, right. I did my first show.
You did your first show because you wanted to learn about the business.
Well, somebody asked me to invest in a radio station.
Right.
And I was always interested in radio, as I pointed out. And I went down and looked. And a half an hour, I'm looking around that place, I could see 100 ways to steal. Now I can see 1,000, but it was 100 then. And I'm thinking, if I can see 100, can you imagine what a pro could do? Hmm. He'd have my pants off and my belt was undone. And I don't like to be in that situation. I described one in the car earlier where a guy was stealing from me. I don't like that very much. And I've had several of those where people have stolen a lot of money from me. Happens. Always my fault, sloppy. So I figured I better get a job. That was all. Learn something. My old man used to say, learn about the seams of the coat. Learn about, you know, don't see what's on the inside's happening. And I think that was good advice. So I got involved. I got a job, which didn't happen quite as quickly as that. It took a year to persuade the guy to even talk to me. And I persuaded him.
I heard two stories. One is you sent him $10,000 in cash and said, this is how much money you're wasting.
I sent him loose bills on a Friday afternoon. So when he opened the package, they kind of collapsed all over his desk.
You're wasting
This is how much money you've wasted by not hiring me. Can you afford to continue to throw this much money away? Knowing full well that he would never allow that money to stay in his desk over a weekend. Uh-huh. So he had to call me to come get it. Uh-huh. I got in his office. Walked out with a job.
The other story. You sent 3,000 letters.
That's similar. No, it's a different station.
That was
WMCA in New York. I sent them over 500 letters and over 3,000
phone calls
before I got my first interview with them.
Now, I'd say that reflects supreme confidence.
You're damn right. I'm better than anybody. I know that. If you don't beat the devil between your ears, going back to the first job, okay, I'm doing this now. You've got to realize this is a different day in radio. I went to Tony and I said, look, I'm the best thing ever happened to your radio station.
Did you know that at the time?
Sure, I knew it. If I didn't, I always know I'm good at what I do. I said, I'm the best you ever had. He said, maybe you are. He said, what do you want? I said, I want to do a nighttime show because I clearly could not afford to mess around in the daytime. I got a living to make and, you know, businesses to run. And he said, well, that's all very well. This is on a Wednesday. It was a Wednesday. Was it Wednesday or Thursday? One of the two. But he said, you know, I can't afford to pay an engineer to run the board for you and so on and so forth. And at that time, you had to have a Class 3 license. And to get a Class 3 license, you had to pass elements 1, 2, and 9 of the FCC test. And I didn't know what the FCC test was. Mm-hmm. I said, what the heck is that all about? He said, well, you got to get this elements 1, 2, and 9. How do you do it? Well, you go to school, do you study, you do this, that, other thing. I said, fine. Went out in the office, and I got hold of somebody in the office. I said, give me all the material you got on the FCC, elements 1, 2, and 9. That was about 4 in the afternoon. I called my then-wife and said, I'm not coming home. I'm going to the office. See you tomorrow. And I stayed up all night, and I read this garbage. And I went to New York the next morning at 9 o'clock when they opened up, took the test at 9:30, walked in with a license at 11 o'clock the next morning, 18 hours later, and said, now, what's your next excuse, Tony? He looked at me. What was he going to say? Mm-hmm. 18 hours later, I laid a license on his face. I didn't know an ohm from a kilowatt, and I still don't. I just regurgitated it and promptly forgot it. The same thing I did with various things on my pilot's license. I memorized them, got past the exam, and forgot it. But the point was that I met him on his own territory. I overcame his objection because he figured he'd keep me out of his face for at least 6 months with that one. What was he going to say? Now what? Mm-hmm. I got him off balance. And I started doing a late night show. I had all the crazies in the world. I had Madeline Murray O'Hare. I had the Nazis, the devil worshippers. On the other side, I had some serious people. I had Ronald Reagan, which is not bad for a relatively small radio, very small radio station. Mm-hmm. I had half a dozen lesbians come in and took their clothes off. They're going to shake me all up, you know. And I mm-hmm. told the kid I was working with, you look them in the eyes, you're dead, man. 3 hours we did that show. Huh. And they're sitting there. You know, it was a good way to cut your teeth, you see, because a microphone, again, as I said earlier, is a microphone. It didn't matter if there was. We used to get a long distance call from Trenton. Stop the presses, kill the commercial. That's a 20-cent call. Put them on, you know. I say outrageous things, outrageous stuff. I mean, it's a late night show, and realize telephone show and there's nobody calling. You got a series. You do a monologue.
Yeah.
I mean, I talked to Letterman about this one time, and he's saying he used to read the Bible. It's anything, weather report, something. It's just a dead air is the one thing you can't do, right? In any event.
When did you develop this Ask Bruce format that you've got?
Well, it was the first thing we did. It was a little more localized, an ombudsman kind of thing. Uh-huh. Then I went to this at-large format, which was kind of fun. It was eclectic, do whatever I want to do. But I get on there, you know, now things are really, the phone is not ringing, right? From 11 to 11:30, it's not going to ring there watching television news. So you knew you got to do a monologue. But after that, you hope they have something. If you had guests, it didn't matter, you see. If you had guests, it doesn't matter if anybody's listening. Because
you got a conversation.
You don't know, right. But you're all by yourself. That's a different matter. So I get on there and say, okay, ladies, it's midnight. I get off here at 2 o'clock in the morning. You have 60 seconds to persuade me that it's your house that I'm going to visit tonight. And I mean, some of the conference was a little lascivious, but at midnight, who cares? Mm-hmm. And the phones would ring. Or you'd say something outrageous, which I won't get into, about, you know, criticize something, and you know that they, well, how could you say something? It didn't matter to me.
You dialed the
lights
phone.
The lights are lighting up now, you see. Yeah. And, but you learn your craft. There is no school in the world that you can learn to do this. You got to sit before one of these stupid things and talk into it. And God knows I've spent time in front of them talking.
Did you develop the idea for TalkNet, this group of people who would talk around the clock?
The group thing, no. But what I did do, I talked to a gal. I have a long memory. When somebody does me a favor, I remember. When somebody does something other than a favor, I should have a vowel for a last name and my last letter of my name because I will remember for rather long periods of time. And I called NBC and I said I had an idea for a radio program and I'd done the thing on Larry King's show and I knew it would work and so forth. And this gal said, well, write us a proposal. And in less than 3 days, she had a bound proposal. And the proposal was titled Talk Radio, National Talk Radio, An Idea Whose Time Has Come. And I proposed what is about 80% of TalkNet today. The one big miss, and I think it's an excusable miss, was the 800 numbers. They were not ubiquitous as they are today. Mm-hmm. She wrote back, which I have all the notes on this. I have her original note, my stuff. We have no intention of doing anything like this, but we would like to keep your proposal on file. Thank you very much. Blah, blah, blah. I was not happy with all this. Particularly not happy to find out 6 weeks later they ran a test on it in Louisville, Kentucky for a week. My idea with a different host. Now I'm ticked off. And I try to get it and see this lady. Never could get past security in at NBC Rockefeller Center. I stood outside the building by the skating rink, which you know where that is, in New York City, and it was an October night, and it was cold, and they were putting the skin of ice on the... They took the tables out of the eating area, and now they're icing the rink. And I'm sitting out there, and I'm not happy. I'm a very unhappy camper. And I gave the then RCA building the Italian salute. And I said, this is going to cost you people. And that was... 78, something like that. Let me see. This is, 91 coming up. This would be 86, 87. I was about a year without a contract, a little less than a year. And the windup was I have a pretty heavy hitter for a negotiator. And we get the deal done. And I walked in. I told him the story you just told him. I just told you, and I gave him the finger. And I said, that just cost you an extra million, or I walk. The guy looked at me and said, I think it's worth $1 million. It cost $1 million.
Huh. And you got the job. We went on the air.
Oh, this was this is after I was an NBC commodity. I was renewing my third contract.
Oh, you had a long memory.
Oh, honey.
Oh, yeah.
Forever. Uh-huh. Forever. I looked the president of NBC right in his face. Said, cost you that little slight cost you $1 million. And he looked at me and said, I think it was worth it. So, you know, you win some and you lose some. I remember those things. Forever. End of story.
This is Bruce Williams. You listen to him in Fairbanks. If you do, if you don't, give the man a try.
KFAR.
On KFAR, 660 on the AM dial.
From 3 to 6 in the afternoon, which is live.
That's
7
live
to
for
10
you.
Eastern, yes.
Right?
I do it from 7 to 10 Eastern, New York City.
Right. Monday through Friday. The rest of the TalkNet crew is Harvey Rubens,
well, you have
Myrna
Lamb. You have Neil Myers and Myrna Lamb during the week,
right.
And the Dolans and Rubin on weekends.
Right. The first group of them do a sort of psychological talk.
Harvey, Neil Myers does a kind of a heartthrob thing, and I guess so does Myrna.
Soft counseling, yeah.
And, I don't think we'd call it counseling, even. I think that's an aggrandizement that he wouldn't be comfortable with.
Uh-huh.
Just talking to people about love and romance, which is appropriate at that hour of the night.
Mm-hmm.
And the Dolans do what should be purely a financial thing, and Ruben is a psychiatrist. Harvey's an interesting guy.
Right.
He's a shrink. And does a shrink show.
All these programs air in Fairbanks on KFAR at different times of the day, different times of the week. You can run into Bruce Williams once again between 3 and 6 weekdays. And the famous number, dial 1-800-TALKNET, a number you cannot dial today.
Son of a gun.
Bruce Williams has written a couple of books. The Bruce Williams source book was a How to Find It. It's out of print, right?
It's gone.
America
History.
Asks Bruce is a series of questions and answers from the show.
That's still around.
You've got a book
coming
out. Got
a new one coming out in the spring. It's How to Start and Run Your Own Business Successfully, which ain't bad. I hate this. This writing books is a bore, and I don't have much interest in it. But then we'll have another one coming out, which I think is going to be fun if I can ever get the damn thing written.
On scams,
On
right?
scams, yeah. But it just... And we also entered into a contract on a retirement book, on kind of a manual of ways to make retirement a little more pleasant and plan for it and that sort of thing. Again, it's not a tome. But, you know, just little things you've been doing to take advantage of the tax laws and looking ahead. And
this is Bruce Williams, a man with a lot of irons in the fire. Thanks for joining us today.
It's been a joy.
It's
you've been very
on
gracious.
Conversations.
I picked on you on your model, but that's my style. What the heck? I'm sure you'd pick on me.
Nah. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations for KUAC-FM in Fairbanks. We'll talk to you again.